Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some top news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people. Knowledge is the best weapon. Today, we are breaking down U.S.-Iran negotiations, going through how significant the killing of the Hamas chief in Gaza is and will be for Israel, why attacks have intensified in Lebanon, and Israeli elections. Will they be held early? With us here to discuss all of that is our political analyst, Binyamin Moalem. He's going to really simplify things for you. Now, let's get to the news. Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. Now, let's get to the news. Binyamin Moalem is deeply engaged in Israeli current events and policy discussions. Having worked as a foreign law clerk at the Supreme Court of Israel, he has a unique vantage point on Israeli jurisprudence. Binyamin now devotes much of this time to curating and explaining current events and politics in Israel on his popular Instagram page, By Moalem, where he provides balanced news coverage from an Israeli perspective for those who are seeking to be informed without an extensive time investment. But I will say he also provides a lot of info about what's happening in Gaza and in Lebanon as well. So he's not just knowledgeable on Israel, he's knowledgeable on the region. Binyamin has authored several thought-provoking featured op-eds and has been featured as a guest lecturer at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Let's bring him in. Welcome to the Israel Daily News, Binyamin Moalem. Thanks for joining us again.
Nice to be with you again, Shanna.
So we do have some developments that we need to break down. Let's start with U.S.-Israel-Iran affairs. There were a lot of people here in Israel holding their breath following U.S. President Trump's return from China, thinking that there might be a flare-up in tensions with Iran, and it seems like the war with Iran is still on pause based on some communications that came out of the White House earlier this week. Can you share with us where are we in the Iran-U.S.-Israel scenario?
Sure. So last week, President Trump said that he canceled an attack that he had scheduled for Tuesday, saying that he had been told that there's still a chance for a deal. Over the weekend, it was reported that the U.S. and Iran were on the cusp of signing something as soon as Sunday, which now we're recording on Wednesday and nothing has been signed yet. Now, this kind of follows a pattern that we've been seeing over and over again over the course of the past 2 months when it comes to dealing with Iran. President Trump oftentimes likes to say things in hopes that it's going to happen. He kind of wills it into existence. This works very well with his allies. It works well with whether it's political allies in the United States, whether it's allies like Israel, when he, you know, the war in Gaza ended, but not working so well with Iran. And we've seen this kind of repeatedly where the U.S. says, you know, we're very close to a deal, and maybe they were, but Iran then kind of feels that it's in the driver's seat because the U.S. kind of loses its leverage by saying we're very close to a deal. And then Iran starts saying, well, by the way, we want more. Yesterday it was reported that Iran was trying to get more, to squeeze more concessions out of the United States, mainly in the realm of sanctions relief. The U.S. was saying that, you know, we're not going to give any sanctions relief or unfreeze any funds until we start seeing concessions on part of Iran when it comes to the nuclear program. Because under the deal that's being discussed, the war would end, the Strait of Hormuz would gradually reopen on both sides for over the period of 30 days, and then there would be a 60-day period during which the U.S. and Iran would negotiate Iran's nuclear program. Now, Iran is saying, well, in order to get to that point, we want sanctions relief. We want money coming back in. Remember, Iran's economy is in shambles. Years of sanctions, the war destroyed a lot of infrastructure, and now this blockade on the Strait of Hormuz has really been suffocating the Iranian economy. And so Iran wants some of this money back. One of the ideas that Iran had been floated reportedly was a $12 billion loan from Qatar, which would probably never have to be repaid. So Iran is looking for money, and this is causing a lot of concern in Israel. Now, again, we don't know all the terms of the deal, but if this deal were to work out, Israel is very concerned that Iran is going to get sanctions relief, help revive its regime, which would be used to fund its military, which is its foremost expense, or its proxies. And then it doesn't even have to give any concessions on its nuclear program just yet, right? One analyst said the U.S. is paying in cash while Iran is paying in credit. Iran is saying, yeah, we'll get to that bridge, and the U.S. what the U.S. is being asked to do by Iran here is to remove the sanctions and allow for, one of the reports were that even if there was no sanctions relief, Iran would be allowed to sell its oil on the open market once the Strait of Hormuz is reopened. Again, we don't know all of the terms of the deal. This is all based on reports. Nothing has been officially released. But there is a lot of concern in Israel. All that said, nothing is far from certain when it comes to signing a deal. The Iranian Supreme Leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, has not indicated that he is going to sign the deal, though there have been reports in U.S. media that U.S. officials have been told that he will approve it. But he has taken a very strong stance. Yesterday, he tweeted that Israel is a cancer that's going to be destroyed within 15 years. And this is before he's made any concessions on his nuclear program. He's also said that death to America and death to Israel are going to be official slogans of Iran. It will be chanted by Iranian school children every day. So these are what we're hearing from Iran is not any sort of messaging that, oh, yeah, we're ready for a deal that involves concessions on our part. Today they said that the war is not going to restart because the U.S. is weak. A lot of taunting on Iran's part. President Trump not one to like being taunted, though the reports we see from the White House is that President Trump really does not want to go back to war. He's got the World Cup coming up very soon, 2 weeks. He's got the U.S. 250 celebrations coming up in a month. And then he's got midterm elections and skyrocketing gas prices. Iran knows this. And like I've said many times on this podcast, we've got a game of chicken between the regime and the Trump administration. The regime is saying, yeah, we're going to take our blows economically. We've taken our blows militarily. But we can hold out until President Trump needs to break because he's got political considerations to take into account versus President Trump trying to wait out his political issues back home until the Iranian regime decides to break under the pressure that it's facing economically, militarily, and from the people themselves in Iran.
Binyamin, thanks for taking us through that. I think an important part of the information that came out at the beginning of the week was that there's no clear understanding of where things are going to go with Iran's nuclear program, and it's something that is going to be tackled in the future, which I understand why that might be that way, because the U.S. officials and Iranians, they're trying to move forward, and there's this one big question of what's going to happen with the nuclear program of Iran. And I think instead of just dealing with it now, the parties are saying, okay, well, let's deal with what's happening right now and right in front of us, the imminent issues, you know, we'll deal with. How different is this arrangement than the JCPOA, which Donald Trump said was the worst deal of all time?
All right, that's a very good question. And again, we don't have the official terms of this deal. And right now they're just negotiating an MOU, which is basically an outline of a deal. This is very common in business deals where before any agreements are signed, the two sides sign a one or two page agreement basically saying, you're going to pay this, I'm going to buy this, we're going to shoot for this, and the terms of the deal are going to be discussed at a later date, 60 days or something like that. And that's what we're seeing right now. Based on the reports that we're hearing, and again, there's no official terms to any nuclear deal. So Iran's been trying to buy time. It's been kind of successful at that so far by pushing off repeated threats by the United States during this period. There were various reports over the past 2 months as to what a deal might include. The main differences between that I could tell based on the reports that I've seen in the JCPOA in 2015 are that, number one, the U.S. has been pushing for a complete freeze on nuclear enrichment for a 15 to 20 year period. The JCPOA did not freeze nuclear enrichment at all. It allowed Iran to enrich uranium until like 3.6%, which is what's needed for civilian use. The U.S. is saying no more enrichment at all for a period of 15 to 20 years. You'll recall the JCPOA had a 10 to 15 year sunset provision on nuclear enrichment, which basically the biggest criticism in Israel was on the JCPOA that at once the period ends, Iran could go ahead and enrich uranium and build a nuclear weapon. The same thing would be theoretically here, according to these reported terms, only that it would take a longer period of time before Iran would be able to do that. But still, as far as Israel is concerned, a funded regime will still be around in 2041 or 2046, just like it's around right now in 2026. The other, another report suggested that the oversight mechanisms would be stricter than the JCPOA. The U.S. would be involved in the oversight part as opposed to just the U.N. Again, just reports. And the third thing here, which would be a somewhat significant difference, is that the Iran's military has been largely destroyed, and its ability to enrich uranium has been largely destroyed by the war last June and the war this past March. So Iran would be starting from it would have to start from zero, basically, when it comes to rebuilding its nuclear program, as opposed to having a nuclear program that's operating and being able to continue it. So again, these are the big picture, not that significant, but they are different from the JCPOA and would give President Trump the ability to say, I negotiated a better deal than the JCPOA, even though for some people in Israel, that might not be enough. It probably would not be enough. Now, one other thing is that significant issue is, you know, since President Trump left the JCPOA, Iran had been enriching uranium at a high pace. It has 450 kilos of highly enriched uranium at 60%, short technical step away from the 90% needed to build a bomb. But it also has about 10 tons of enriched uranium at lower levels. I think this includes something like 2 tons enriched at about 20%, and then several tons more that are enriched above the uranium ore, meaning they have a lot of uranium that's in various stages of nuclear enrichment. And one of the things that's going to be a point of contention in any negotiation with Iran is, not only do we want you to relinquish that 450 kilos of highly enriched uranium, we also want you to relinquish all 10 tons of enriched uranium that you have in your possession, except for whatever might be needed to power their civilian nuclear plant in Bushehr. So that is also going to be a point of contention. As far as we know, Mojtaba said he is not going to allow any uranium to be released. Again, that could change. U.S. sources say that Iranian officials have been more reasonable and more practical in the negotiations than they have been in public. But these are all things that are going to have to be negotiated and will all be used to judge whether or how much better this deal is going to be if one indeed is signed in the end versus the 2015 deal.
Very interesting. Thanks for taking us through that. And certainly, I assume that the facade that people put on outside is different than whatever people are bringing to the negotiating table. I would assume having a face-to-face meeting with somebody, it's got to be hard to be so tough all the time. It really looks like there's been a lot of mess and a lot of fighting. And for us to be left at this point where the biggest question of the entire scenario, which is the nuclear deal, is something that needs to be worked on in the future, a little bit hard to believe. So we're going to have to see what happens with that. Right now, it feels a little bit like a Band-Aid, if you ask me, even though there's been a big effort to reduce the army and to reduce their missile stockpile, which we know is a direct threat for Israel. But I think a lot of Israelis here at home are feeling like they want to know that this situation has been resolved entirely and is not just on pause, putting us all a little bit in limbo over here. Let's take us over to Israel and the Gaza Strip. Some developments have come out. We haven't really been seeing Gaza spoken about as much in the news lately, especially since the February attacks between Israel and Iran. Tell us what is going on in Gaza, what is going on with Hamas, and what are the developments there?
All right, so last night, 11 days after Israel took out the military leader of Hamas in Gaza at the time is Adin al-Haddad. The new military leader, Mohammed Odeh, has been killed as well. He was killed in an airstrike last night in the safe house that he was hiding out in. And he had taken over for Izzeddin al-Haddad shortly after his assassination. Now, he was the head of Hamas's intelligence on October 7th, so he was also involved in the October 7th attack. This comes also a few days after a Wall Street Journal report outlined, detailed Israel's plan to kill or capture every single terrorist involved in the October 7th attack. And so one more is now gone. We don't have an indication as to who might succeed him. This is reminiscent of the 2004 when Israel killed Ahmed Yassin, the spiritual leader and the founder of Hamas, who was leading Hamas in Gaza. And 3 weeks later, his successor, Abdelaziz al-Rantisi, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. This was at the height of the Second Intifada.
How significant is this?
So it really sends a message to Hamas. Now, again, the leadership of Hamas from before the war is becoming smaller and smaller, if there's anybody left at all at this point. You know, Hamas is on its fourth or fifth tier of leadership. Following the October 7th attack, you had the Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Def running the show before October 7th. They were killed in 2024. You had Mohammed Sinwar, Yahya's brother, and you had Marwan Issa was actually killed before the first two. He was the head of the, he was Mohammed Def's deputy. So they were both killed. Then you have the five brigade leaders of Hamas's military brigades in Gaza. Four of them were killed until Izzeddin al-Haddad was killed a couple weeks ago. He was the fifth one, so they're all dead. You had a couple senior officials, the head of procurement and logistics, Raad Saad. He was killed this past December. And now you have the head of intelligence who assumed the leadership of Hamas, Mohammed Odeh, and he's now dead. So Hamas is going to be going lower and lower, and you know, less senior members, people with less experience to run the terrorist organization. So this could potentially be very significant for Israel in terms of having somebody who is able to unite Hamas, which is already, you know, pretty battered from the war, and turning it back into some sort of formidable military force. That said, they have recruited tens of thousands of young men during the war and following the war. And again, they're not as well trained, they're not as well organized, but they're still bodies holding guns, and that poses a threat to Israel. And also, it allows Hamas to retain control over the portion of Gaza it still has control over, the something like 43% of Gaza.
Are you able to give us an update on what's happening in Gaza for the civilians? Are they, what's happening there? What are people doing, and how are people moving forward? What are people's day-to-day lives looking like? Obviously, you're not living in Gaza, but I understood that there are or were elections.
So the elections that were in Gaza was one municipality in that really was largely untouched during the war. In central Gaza, one of two towns that the IDF didn't get into. So there were municipal elections held there. This is something like 70,000 people, relatively insignificant. Hamas still runs the show in Gaza. They want to give off the impression that they're not, that they're kind of stepping back. You know, Hamas might be willing and has expressed willingness to step back from the administrative control of Gaza, but they have not expressed any willingness to give up its military control over Gaza. They don't want to relinquish their weapons. They kind of want to go back to the way things were when the Palestinian Authority ran Gaza, but they still had this armed military. If you think about Hezbollah, especially before this past war, where Hezbollah didn't have to deal with the administrative control of running a country like Lebanon, but they still were the most powerful military around, and they were able to focus on, you know, whatever their agenda was and whatever that meant in terms of fighting against Israel. That's what Hamas wants in Gaza. They're happy with the Palestinian Authority or this technocratic government that has been established running the show.
Or UNRWA.
Sorry?
Or UNRWA.
UNRWA was more of a, if you could call them a charity organization, but they were basically bringing in aid in schools, but they weren't, you know, running a civilian Palestinian offer, right. And so they're fine with a new government doing that so long as they can maintain their military, and that's unacceptable to Israel. So that's really the main point of contention, because as far as Israel is concerned, who cares who runs the civil administration in Gaza? It's more, do they pose a threat to Israel? And so long as Hamas is armed, it poses a threat to Israel.
Of course. And the question always comes down to who is Israel going to support? And what I mean by that is that if the Gazan population doesn't have any administrative body to provide the basics, a lot of global leaders look to Israel and say, what are you going to do, Israel? How are you going to provide? How are you going to turn the lights on and get education and civil duties to the Gazan people? So in my view, it's just it's really a big frustration and a big shame to see that Hamas, of course they want to keep their military alive. Of course. It's the hard day-to-day work of making sure that people have jobs and that people have schools to go to and that things are running and that people have utilities. That's the part that nobody really wants to take care of. Am I right?
Well, yeah, but that's also something that Israel has never claimed responsibility for. Israel handed over the keys to Gaza in 2005. And since then, there are certain things that do come from Israel, like the control of the borders, and Israel has been allowing aid in for months now. Uninterrupted aid has been coming into Gaza. Hamas has been stealing much of that and using it to fund its recruitment of more soldiers, to pay for whatever bills Hamas has. So this is something that is really an issue for Israel, is that it's by allowing all these things in and trying to do this for the aid of the Palestinian people in Gaza, it's indirectly funding Hamas, because Hamas steals the aid or taxes the aid and makes money off of it. And so that's really the main concern. What happens inside of Gaza, very unfortunate to any innocent civilians living there, but that is not, that Israel cannot be held responsible for that, because this is the government they have. Now, again, they haven't had elections in, like, national elections in 20 years, but Hamas did win the last election, and Hamas still commands the support of a majority of Palestinians in the West Bank and not a small number of Palestinians in Gaza, despite what has happened over the past 3 years.
Thank you for taking us through that. I'm definitely dealing with a lot of suggestions like that from the world, you know, in my inbox online, dealing always with people having expectations of Israel clearing things up and being the power in the region. There's a lot of expectations of responsibility, and I'm constantly trying to explain to people that Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005. And that it's really not Israel's responsibility to figure out the utilities and operations for day-to-day Gazan life. So thank you for explaining that. I'd like you to take us on to another front that Israel is dealing with that has been very prominent in the last year. Lebanon. What is going on with Israel and Lebanon, i.e. Hezbollah, the terror organization running Lebanon's south?
All right, so last month, the United States pretty much, and we talked about this earlier, about how President Trump kind of wants to will something into being. He does. And I think his close relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu, you know, a lot has been talked about how there have been issues, but I don't ever remember a U.S. administration working so closely with an Israeli administration, whether it's Iran and other things that are going on. So President Trump basically said there's got to be a ceasefire in Lebanon, and one was declared. However, that was a ceasefire in name only. The U.S. said, you know, you got to defend yourself. Hezbollah continued to attack Israel. Israel continued to hit Hezbollah targets in South Lebanon. Now, Israel did scale back its attacks. It was attacking a lot less than it was during the height of the war, and also refrained from striking anywhere in the Beirut area. Now, this is all to help the U.S. with its negotiations with Iran. Iran is saying that, you know, if there's a war going on in Lebanon, we will not talk to you. So the U.S. declared a ceasefire. So even though there has not been a ceasefire, those talks have been ongoing, but Israel has been refraining from striking in Beirut, and that's kind of like been the understanding, you know, scale back the attacks, don't strike Beirut, and the talks will continue between the U.S. and Iran. Now, Hezbollah has been taking advantage of the situation and has been firing hundreds of drones, hundreds of missiles at northern Israel and at troops who are in southern Lebanon. Now, these drones are not the drones that we are all familiar with that are operated wirelessly. These are fiber optic drones, drones that are operated by a small wire that can go on for kilometers, and they are much harder to detect by air defenses because they're not controlled electronically. And so, therefore, these drones have been going into Israel and wreaking havoc amongst residents of northern Israel and troops who are in southern Lebanon, and also creating lots and lots of these wires just kind of landing everywhere, which look like netting. And Israel is under a lot of pressure to deal with this threat. And so two nights ago, the prime minister finally said, that's it, we're done. And the U.S. pretty much greenlit an Israeli escalation in attacks on Hezbollah in South Lebanon. And Israel pretty much doubled its attacks over the past day than what it was before on Hezbollah. The IDF troops that are stationed in South Lebanon have crossed the Lebanese yellow line. This is the line between where IDF troops are and the northern border of Israel. They have crossed that to the north and are now engaging with Hezbollah terrorists north of that. However, Israel is still not striking in Beirut. One official said that if there is a immediate target that needs to be struck that is hiding in Beirut, whether it's a person or a threat, then they will do so. But in the meantime, out of deference to the United States, Israel is not striking Beirut, but is hitting targets in South Lebanon, hitting targets in the Bekaa Valley, which is in eastern Lebanon, and really trying to do everything it can to stem the tide of these attacks on northern Israel. There are a number of, on the technological front, there are a number of efforts underway to try to figure out how to deal with these drones. But according to Israeli officials, that could take some time before those are fully developed.
Thank you for taking us through that, Binyamin. Question about what's going on here in Israel politically. What are we dealing with in the Knesset? Are we going to go to early elections in September? What's the latest?
Okay, so as of today, May 27th, the Knesset has already passed one reading of a bill that would dissolve the Knesset. This was passed 110-0, so both sides agreed. Now, this was really just a way for those who are within the coalition or upset with the prime minister to say, you know, hey, we want to go to new elections. This is the Haredi parties who are upset over the lack of a Haredi draft exemption law for yeshiva students. But there was no actual date set. The law still needs to pass two more times. And the coalition seems perfectly happy to sit on this law and not continue to pass it. Now, the opposition is going to bring another one to the table, I think, as early as next week. However, many people were hoping for a September 1st election. That is almost 100% not going to happen because the dissolution law would have to pass three readings by June 1st, and that's just not going to happen. That would be next Monday. So if Shas has its way, the elections would be held on September 15th. That means that the dissolution law would have to be passed by June 15th, which is possible. The prime minister is still trying to buy as much time as possible. The elections are currently scheduled for October 27th. They cannot be held any later than that. And if a dissolution law is passed, it doesn't necessarily have to have a date. So it would just have elections would have to be held between 3 to 5 months after the law is passed, which that October 27th date does fall squarely within that time period. Now, the Haredi parties, there has been this past week, the UTJ party, this is the Ashkenazi Haredi party, has really kind of escalated its disappointment with the Netanyahu administration. They're very, very upset. Their spiritual leader said that he does not trust Netanyahu. He doesn't want to deal with the prime minister anymore. And there have been talks between Moshe Gafni, who is the head of the Degel HaTorah faction of the UTJ party. UTJ party is really two parties, Degel HaTorah and Agudat Yisrael. Degel HaTorah represents the non-Hasidic Ashkenazi Haredim, and Agudat Yisrael represents most Hasidic factions in Israel. And so he met with Gadi Eisenkot, who is a prominent opponent. He's a prominent member of the opposition. He's no longer in the Knesset, but he is leading the Yashar party, which is currently polling at about 16 seats after following the Likud party and the merger between Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid. Now, he's also hoping to gain more traction and perhaps be a prime minister candidate, and he's hoping that perhaps he can bring the Haredi parties into a government led by him, and that would pretty much end Netanyahu's stranglehold on this right-wing bloc, which includes his party, the Bezalel Smotrich Religious Zionism Party, Itamar Ben-Gvir's Otzma Yehudit Party, Shas, and UTJ, because that has pretty much blocked the opposition from forming a coalition. But if you can pull one of those parties and to the opposition, it's quite possible that they could form a coalition without Netanyahu. However, it is, I don't see how it's likely that the opposition will be able to agree to a draft law that is more generous than the one that's currently on the table by the Prime Minister that could not muster enough votes in the current coalition. The opposition wants a much stronger stance against the any sort of Haredi draft law. Now, Gadi Eisenkot is seen as more giving towards the Haredi community versus, you know, Naftali Bennett or Yair Lapid, which don't want any exemptions granted. Gadi Eisenkot is prepared to grant some exemptions to yeshiva students, the top 3% or whatever it is, but the Haredim want everybody who is studying to receive an exemption, and there doesn't appear that anybody is willing to grant that. Again, politics are politics and things could change, but I don't see how the Haredi parties are going to get a better deal, so to speak, from the current opposition than they're currently getting from the coalition. Now that leaves us with, you know, what happens when the elections are over. Prime Minister Netanyahu, currently his coalition is polling at 53, 54, whatever it is, seats, not enough to form a government. The opposition is polling at 57, 58, also not enough to form a 61-seat government. And we could be headed for another deadlock like we saw in 2019, 2020. One suggestion that has been floating, that been floated around, I don't see the Prime Minister agreeing to this, but that Prime Minister Netanyahu, you'll recall he's under a criminal trial that's been going on for years now. And there have been a number of plea bargain ideas that have floated around, offering the Prime Minister a deal. But all these deals that have been offered by the prosecution have involved him resigning from politics and stepping aside. And the Prime Minister has said, absolutely not. I'm staying in politics. I'm staying Prime Minister. Keep the trial going. I'll be acquitted. If the Prime Minister sees that he is not going to win the election, some are suggesting that he'll take a plea bargain now because as Prime Minister, he has a lot more leverage when it comes to negotiating a plea bargain than he does if he's not Prime Minister. And so some are saying, well, okay, he's 76 years old, take a plea bargain, maybe he'll just decide it's time to retire. Knowing what I know about the Prime Minister over the past 20 years, I don't see him doing that, but it's something that he might consider if he sees he's not going to win the election or if he sees that he's going to lose the election outright, he might as well get what he can and use his leverage while he still has it. Something that somebody might think about. One more thing, this was suggested this past week, and again, it's not possible because the numbers aren't there, but Israel has a mechanism by which the Knesset can replace the Prime Minister midterm. Another person can step up and say he can build a coalition, have the Knesset vote out the current Prime Minister and in a new Prime Minister. That has never been done before. There was an attempt to do that during during Yitzhak Shamir's term as Prime Minister in the late 80s to replace him with Shimon Peres. That failed, but there was a suggestion between the opposition trying to pitch to UTJ, which is very upset with the Prime Minister right now because of the lack of a Haredi draft law, to replace the Prime Minister now with Benny Gantz. This sounds a little bit strange. Benny Gantz right now is not even polling above the four-seat threshold, but he is well-liked in the Knesset by members of the Knesset on both sides of the political aisle. And opposition said, like right now the opposition leader is Yair Lapid. They said, hey, you guys want to punish the Prime Minister. Why don't you join us and we'll make Yair Lapid Prime Minister before the elections in October. That way you've punished the Prime Minister. Yair Lapid will be the incumbent going into the next election. Again, the election wouldn't change in this scenario. Haredim were like, no, Yair Lapid has not been our friend, and so we're not going to agree to that. They're like, okay, well, what about Benny Gantz? And the opposition said, we'll agree to do this so long as Benny Gantz decides to step down and not run in the next election. Benny Gantz said that he never got any suggestion like this, but again, even if this were to happen, UTJ only has 7 seats. With the opposition, that only equals 59 seats, not enough to unseat the current government, but just something interesting about Israeli politics of how it could work.
Thank you. Well, that's fun. It is going to be a fun ride, as always, in Israeli politics, but thank you for breaking that down for us. Binyamin Moalem, you are a gem. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Shanna. Nice to see you.
The Israel Daily News now has its own direct donation platform after losing dozens of supporters last year during Spotify's takeover of my distribution site. Listeners can now contribute monthly or make a one-time donation directly through the website. Special thanks goes out to loyal supporters like Marianne Vollinger for sticking through the transition. Support helps keep our independent journalism alive and growing. You can also follow Israel Daily News across our social media platforms like Instagram, TikTok, X, and LinkedIn at israeldaily.news or Israel Podcast if you're looking on X. And now for a Torah thought by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York.
One of the major discussions in this week's Torah portion is that of a nazir, someone who makes a Nazirite vow. And a nazir is someone who cannot come into contact with certain types of impurity, especially that of a dead body. And they also forbid themselves from partaking of anything related to grapes, whether that's the seeds, the skins, the grapes themselves, even if they're dried into raisins, any kind of juice that's made from them, certainly wine. And therefore, the Haftorah discusses the Nazirite vow of Samson. His mother actually makes the vow for him by the command of the angel, or his parents make the vow for him, and they raise him as a Nazir, and then he has to, at the time of his bar mitzvah, choose to do it as an adult. And interestingly enough, when the angel tells Samson's mother that her child is going to be raised as a Nazir, he says that he's going to be raised as a Nazirite from the womb. And when the mother tells this over to her husband, she says he has to be a Nazir until the day of his death. Now, the angel didn't actually say that, because the truth is that Delilah, Samson's future wife, right, she is going to terminate his Nazirite-ness, because one of the things that, I don't know if that's a word, but it's okay, his Nazirus, as we would say in Hebrew, she terminates it by cutting off his hair, because another thing that a Nazirite can't do is have their hair cut. But the mother didn't know that, so there's sort of this mistake here where she adds the words until the day of his death. And we actually see something similar to this with the tree of knowledge of good and evil, where Chava, Eve, also adds, right? They're told not to eat of the tree. And so Chava tells the snake, we're not allowed to eat of it or touch it, right? She sort of adds to God's commandment. And this leads, obviously, to the downfall, where she does touch the tree. The snake pushes her into it. Oh, see, it's fine. You can touch it, so you can also eat it. And it doesn't work out very well. And I'm not sure if there's a connection here exactly, where here his mother adds the thing to the day of his death and it doesn't work out well. So it is okay to add to the commandments, right? We add all the time. Judaism is full of things that are not mentioned in the Bible. They're additions that we made as fences around the Torah to protect ourselves from actually transgressing the biblical commandments. It's okay to add, but you have to recognize the difference between things that we add in order to protect ourselves from transgressing God's law and what the actual law is itself. Right? We shouldn't add and then say, oh, this is actually from God. Regardless, what does this idea of the Nazirite teach us? Right? These are only certain specific individuals that take on this kind of vow, and it could be for 30 days, it could be like in Samson's situation for his whole life, but what does that have to do with us? The truth is that we all have to be a Nazirite to some degree, meaning that we have to separate ourselves from things that are mundane and common everyday life, and we should devote ourselves to spiritual growth and refinement. And this includes especially setting up fixed times for Torah study and for prayer and meditation and really performing God's commandments in the best possible way, right? Seeking God in everything, even the mundane things in our life, trying to find the godliness and the spirituality even within that. And in truth, despite that being a very lofty goal, even that's not enough. Because it's very easy to pursue those kinds of ideals, even for selfish reasons. And that's why the angel tells his mother that he needs to be a Nazirite to God. Meaning that the test of whether we're a Nazirite to God is that if we're doing it for his sake and not just for our own glorification or self-refinement or trying to have some sort of status symbol as a spiritual person. But are we doing what Samson is commanded to do, right? To save Israel from the hand of the Philistines, meaning to seek out others who are really hurting, whether knowingly or unknowingly, under their servitude of materialism and physicality, and encourage them and guide them toward realizing their divine potential and fulfilling their divine mission. Shabbat Shalom.
All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Don't forget that I'm going to be hosting the Jerusalem Post New York Conference this upcoming week. We have a gala on Sunday evening, and we have a full day of programming on Monday. So our usual Monday-Thursday podcast programming might be affected. Don't forget to sign up to our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with our top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week, and of course with a personal note from me at the top. You can sign up for that at israeldailynews.org. Scroll down to the bottom of our website and drop your email address in. A big thank you goes out to Marianne Vollinger, our writer Perry Schwartz, and our associate producer Lori May. Have a great and productive day and an excellent weekend. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.